Good morning, or good afternoon, whatever it is. Scripture reading this morning comes from Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. This should be familiar to most of us. Ye are the salt of the earth. But if the salt have lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and be trodden under foot of men. Ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. Well, I want to begin here by saying Happy Mother's Day to those to whom it applies. And speaking of Dale mentioning that a moment ago, I'm just surprised you didn't mention that Mother's Day started in the great state of West Virginia some years ago. But anyway, as I was thinking about what to preach about this week, I was thinking about the fact that there's certainly no greater influence in this world than the influence of a mother. And that being so, there certainly can be no greater influence then in this world than that of a Christian mother. And then I got to thinking, well, then there can't possibly be any better influence in this world than a Christian, period. And maybe as we consider mothers, because it reminds us of their influence in our lives and what a great influence it is. And that may be for the better or it may be for the worse. I hope that your experience has been that it's been for the better, or that if it hasn't been, that you've had some mothers in your life that have shown you what mothers can show. There's certainly no place where you find the love of God in greater measure than in a mother, and in particular, a Christian mother. The song that we sung a moment ago wasn't selected by me, but I think in some ways it's a good lead-in to our lesson today. In the sweet by and by. That's a good thing to think about, isn't it? The sweet by and by. That means the tomorrow. That means the Sabbath that never ends. That means that day that we are to enter into as Christians that will go on forever, where there will be no more sorrow and no more parting and no more death. And that is sweet. But what about the now and now? Can't it be just a little sweeter? It should be. Now, if we're looking for this world to get a little bit sweeter, it's never going to be by and by. But if we want this world to be just a little bit sweeter, I suggest that we all take serious inventory of how and from where we imagine that change will come. Because if we assume that the changes that are needed to make this a sweeter now and now are going to come from yelling at the idiot box, as my dad used to call it, or thinking that we're going to change it from the top down with regard to politics and politicians, if that's our priority, if we think that politics and economics and all of that is how we make it a little sweeter now and now, not that those things cannot be or should not be affected in some way, but if that's where we think the priority is, we as a people of God are sorely mistaken. The way that the world changes for the better and becomes sweeter for the better, both for us and for those who live in this world with us, it begins within. It begins within the individual. It begins within the individual who is related to and belongs to Christ. But this morning I'd like to talk about our influence. Our influence. And I'd like to talk about it in three facets. Number one, the nature of it. Number two, the scope of it. And number three, the value of it. The nature and the scope and the value. If we look at Matthew 5 and verse 13, we'll see first the nature of our influence. And it's in the very first word that has been changed in modern translations. This is not a harp against modern translations. We must continue the work of translation for the evolving use of language. I don't have a problem with that. However, in the King James Version, there's a word here that begins this section, and it's used a couple of times, and it's an important word if you understand the language that was being used to translate this and was still in use in 1885 when the last major revision was done. Now, there's been revisions since then. But it's the word Y-E, ye. I hear that misused a lot, usually as in a jocular way about the language of the Bible, you know, sort of mocking. Oh, you say ye and thee and thou and all of that. Well, all that has its place and meaning. Actually, there's some rich value to that if you're interested in discovering it. But nonetheless, there's nothing wrong with taking it out and putting the word you in there. However, the sense in which, and the reason why that this word was chosen is because it represents a lot more than appears on the surface. It actually has three elements to it, or three different things that it means. First of all, it means all of you. Remember, this is a passage about influence. Ye are what? The salt of the earth and the light of the world. That's about influence. There's no denying that. But he says ye. Well, that means, first of all, it means all of you. Right? In the South, it's y'all. Right? All of you. As a collective. So it implies the collective. A second thing that it implies is not only you as a collective, but you as in each one of you. Well, the collective is made of the sum of its parts, is it not? So Christians have an influence as a body. Christians have an influence as individuals. We need to respect that and appreciate that. Then there's a third sense in which this word is used, and this is developed by the context. Not just the word itself, but the manner in which the word's being used here with all the other words that are around it. It means you, all of you. It means you individually, and it means you and only you. It involves the exclusivity of the influence of a Christian and the exclusivity of the influence of Christians as a collective. That's what Jesus is teaching in this passage. All of you have influence, each of you have influence, and only you can be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. Now, I'm aware that people can be salt of the earth people and light of the world people that aren't Christians. However, nobody can be a salt of the earth person or a light of the world person without the influence of Christ. It comes from Him. It emanates from Him. He is the pinnacle. And so those who do so by virtue of the good fortune of being alive in this world some 2,000 years removed from Christ and under the umbrella or blanket of His influence, enact the principles of Christ, do so accidentally at times, are not doing it for the glory of Christ. Only Christians do that. We do that decidedly. We do that by choice. we enact Christ in our lives to the best of our abilities, such that he might be glorified. It's all of us, it's each of us, and in some respect, it's only us. We all have the potential to bring something unique to this world by the life that God has granted us, your gifts, your abilities. The sphere of influence that has been given you is a gift of God to be nurtured, to be utilized for the glory of God. That's the nature of it. The second point is the scope of our influence. And we find that in both of these first two verses. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Possibly an allusion to Jerusalem in verse 14, a city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Why? Well, because it can be seen for miles around, especially at night, as it would have been aglow years ago with torches and such, and now I imagine with modern conveniences. But you can't hide it. There it is. So also with us. What is the scope of our influence? Well, if I asked you, let's think of it this way. If I asked for you to list what you thought were maybe the top 3 to 5 priorities of Jesus, it's really just a mental exercise. You're already thinking about it. What are the top 3 to 5 priorities of Jesus? What would I say about that? We all have our answers, but I assume most of them would be fairly similar. Well, now let's turn that to us. The scope of our influence. I'll tell you what the scope of our influence isn't. It's not just the stuff that's said after we pass from this life in an obituary or by those that come to eulogize. A eulogy is by nature, it comes from Greek, which involves the idea of goodness. So a eulogy is, I want to say something kind. In every funeral that I've ever done, and rightly so, I assume, in every funeral that I've ever been a part of, there's been a eulogy that's been given, and I've never heard one where someone talked about what a scalawag someone was. They usually talk about all of the good things, and that's fine. That's what we focus upon, and that's fine. But here's another way to look at our influence and the scope of our influence. Let's not think about how our obituary would be written or what people would say about us, because generally speaking, that's going to be favorable for most people. And, you know, it's going to be a little bit of fluff. People are going to talk me probably a little better than I was. Now, if I really want to know what my influence is while I yet live, maybe I could ask the people around me what they would say my top 3 to 5 priorities are. The people that know you, your family members, your spouse, your children, your coworkers, what would they say my top 3 to 5 priorities are? I think that would be a pretty good gauge of what kind of influence I'm having with other people. That might be a scary thing to ask other people. Hopefully, it would be a good exercise. It's probably not the kind of thing that we do very often, but it would probably be a good exercise to gauge the kind of influence we're having with the people around us. What do they know about us? What do they see in us? Are we the light of their world? Are we the salt to their earth? Is there anyone else bringing light or salt into the lives of the people around us? And would they say so about us? I'm not talking about what they'd say about us when we're gone. Oh, yeah, he gave me the shirt off his back, came over and used to help me in the garden and all of this. That's good. That's not the question. The question is, where do my priorities lie? And how would people see those priorities? Perhaps an eye-opening experiment. But on a grander scale, I'd like to think with you here, as we've talked about the individual and also the collective, I'd like to just think about for just a moment with you here on this point of what Christianity as a general concept, and sometimes it doesn't even matter if the Christianity is gotten right, as it were. Now, it matters to us individually. What history refers to as Christianity isn't always Christianity. A lot of times it's just Christianity's a political football that's been kicked around by governments and people for their own purposes. I mean, that can happen. It happens to churches. It certainly happens when it infiltrates governments. That's historically what happens. So you have to be real careful when you talk about Christianity. That means a lot of things to a lot of people. But even with that, the influence of Christ on this world and on individuals who believe they're following Christ is so tremendous that it often overrides the errors, almost always overrides the errors that the individuals who are following it commit. Because Christ is so great and his influence so powerful and so commendable. There is no other influence like it on earth. The historian Kenneth Scott Latourette once said the very thing, that the evidence is mounting, that by historical standards, as far as influence is concerned, Christ stands first. There's nobody more influential than him. And as such, there's been nobody more greatly influenced than those that have professed to follow him. Erroneous as they may be in their own way, as all of us are to some degree. But in the grand scheme of things, I hear this argument a lot of times that Christians have done this or they have done that or that they've been accused of doing such and so on. And sometimes those that profess to be Christians have done bad things. There's no doubt about that. But on the whole, this world has been infinitely better, not only for Christ, but for those who have attempted to follow him. I want to read a passage to you that I think is important. It comes from a book that I also think is a good book, a very good book. But of course, I always have to precursor this with, well, it's written by men, so is it going, it's not the Bible. Okay, so take the meat, spit out the bones. But I want you to hear a little bit of this because Christians are, it's been a little bit of sport, I think, of late, maybe of recent decades even to, and this goes round and round, it's circular. So we're kind of at some point where there's more increase of this now. We're no worse off than anybody's ever been. We're a lot better off than a lot of people have been. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying it is the way it is that Christians get criticized and blamed for things. I mean, it goes all the way back to Nero. But nevertheless, I want to read this passage from this book. I'll give you the book and the author. I have it with me, and if you want to know afterwards, I'll let you know. The medieval era in Europe saw the founding of the university, which would have a crucial role in the growth of modern science. At first, monks labored in monasteries, working tirelessly to retrieve the classical knowledge destroyed when barbarians overran the Roman Empire and spread chaos throughout the continent. For several centuries, monasteries were the only institutions in Europe for the acquisition, the preservation, and the transmission of knowledge. Then the churches began to build schools. First at the elementary, and then the secondary level. Eventually, these became more advanced until in the 12th century, the first universities were founded in Bologna and Paris. Oxford and Cambridge were founded in the early 13th century, followed by universities in Rome, Naples, Salamanca, Seville, Prague, Vienna, Cologne, and Heidelberg. These institutions might be affiliated with the church, but they were independently governed and operated. The curriculum was both theological and secular, so that the new scientific knowledge of early modern times could be accommodated. As Alvin Schmidt points out, many of America's earliest colleges or universities, Harvard, the College of William and Mary, Yale, Northwestern, Princeton, Dartmouth, Brown, all began as Christian institutions. A Franciscan bishop, Robert something, whose name I can't pronounce, who was the first chancellor of Oxford University, proposed that knowledge could be accumulated through an inductive experimental method. A couple of centuries later, Francis Bacon, a devoutly religious man who wrote treatises on the Psalms and on prayer, used the inductive method to record experimental outcomes. Bacon argued that through the God-given power of discovery, man could fulfill the divine mandate to establish dominion over creation and even restore a new kind of Eden. See, he's a little off in his thinking. But do you see why he's being influenced by? Today, Bacon is considered the founder of the scientific method, the inventor of invention. Why? Because he had such a high regard for our Creator and for Christ. It was under the auspices of the church that the first medical research institutions, the first observatories were built and supported. From the Middle Ages to the Enlightenment, a period of several centuries, the church did far more for Western science than did any other institution. In fact, we wouldn't have what we have today that argues and slaps the face of God if it wasn't for people who believed they were Christians trying to declare and decipher the glory of God. We often hear that science was founded in the 17th century in revolt against religious dogma. In reality, science was founded between the 13th and 14th centuries through a dispute between two kinds of religious dogma. The first kind held that scholastic debate, operating according to strict principles of deductive reason, was the best way to discover God's hand in the universe. The other held that inductive experience, including the use of experiments to interrogate nature, was the preferred approach. Science benefited from both methods, using experiments to test propositions and then rigorous criticism and argumentation to establish their significance. Historian Lynn White shows how the new scientific method launched an explosion of innovations and inventions starting in the 13th century. The 14th century was, according to John Gimple, one of the great inventive eras of mankind. The technological revolution described by White and Gimple was unlike anything known in classical times. Between the trial and error agricultural techniques of the monasteries and the new theoretical and experimental study of the universities, Europe developed a new way of understanding nature and making it work for human purposes. A continent once desolate was soon dotted with schools and farms and workshops, all taking learning and agricultural production and trade to a new level. Inventions of the period included the water wheel, the windmill, the chimney, eyeglasses, and the mechanical clock. Humble these may seem, but they are responsible for launching a civilization that would soon, in learning, affluence, and power, dwarf all other cultures of the world. Why? Seeking God. Desiring to demonstrate the principles of God. Desiring to understand the principles of God. The influence of Christ is what changes the world. Now, these are very particular things in this instance. How much more powerful then when the influence of Christ through someone trying to walk like him changes the heart of another individual? What is the scope of our influence? Time will never tell. Only eternity will show all the good that has been done by those who profess to follow him. All of us collectively in one sense, but each of us individually, and in some sense only us. That's the nature and the scope of it. Finally then, the value of it. In verse 16 of the passage, going back again, let your light so shine before men that, there's the word of purpose. Why? That they may see your good works, not in ostentatious display. That's talked about as well. But rather, that they may glorify your Father which is in heaven. That's the value. See, there's a simple premise to the Bible. There's a lot of premises to the Bible, I suppose. One giant premise, which is the redemption of man through his Creator. But there's a million other sub-premises to that. And one of those premises of the Bible is that man is at his best. And by the way, isn't that really what humanity is often after? It's a couple of big things. One is, what can we do to be our best? That's one of those things. You know, what is the meaning of life? What are we really looking for? Well, man at his best. I mean, we all want to be our best, right? Live the best life we can live. We're here for a short time. We'd like to make it count. We better make it count, because this is all we've got. Well, the premise of the world, or the world has a lot of different ways of looking at that and throwing things at us and saying, this will be valuable. This will be a worthwhile way to spend your time and your life and so on here on the earth. The premise of the Bible runs contradictory to a lot of that stuff that gets thrown at us. The premise of the Bible is that man is at his best, not when he's seeking for himself and his own glory, but when he is seeking to glorify his Creator. And so the opposite of that would then be perhaps the most destructive thing a human being can do. To draw the attention only to his or herself. To withdraw from the Creator. To minimize the glory of the Creator. Everything in this creation, according to the Bible, as I understand it, is about the glorification of God. All of the physical creation is for the glorification of God, is it not? Is that not what the 19th Psalm says? The heavens declare what? The glory of God. Why does God need to be glorified? Is it some self-aggrandizing activity that he's involved in? Is he a megalomaniac? Does God just need to be patted on the back? The glorification of God is not for God. God doesn't need to be made bigger. Can he be made bigger? Can God feel better about himself? When it comes to those things, categorically, God is not like us. He doesn't have needs that need to be fulfilled, and he'll take whatever he can get to fill them. No, that's us. We might impose that upon him, but that's not him. That's us. So what with this glorification of God? And I've heard that argument numerous times. You've probably heard it in various fashion. Well, why does God need to be glorified? Why does he need to be worshipped? What kind of megalomaniacal God is that? But God doesn't need my worship. I'm not filling a hole that's empty inside of God. I need to glorify God in my heart, in my mind, in my life. God needs to be bigger to me, lest I make him smaller than he is. I haven't even begun to glorify God. I haven't even begun to put God in the category where he belongs. I only crudely attempt to do it. On my best days, on my worst days, I put him in my back pocket and tell him to go away. I've got better things to think about. That's humanity. That's what we do. We need to glorify. And we're not at our best when we don't do that. We're miserable. We're wasting our time. We need to glorify God so that other men can glorify God. We do what we do as Christ so that other people can see there's more to this life than just the self, than just the eating of food and the wearing of clothes, all the rubbish nonsense that we have to go through to live in this shell. There's more to it than that. You're not going to be in this shell forever. People need to see that. That's what it means to glorify God. People need to see that there's something greater than themselves, a higher purpose. And by the way, I want to take you back to the great scientists, not Christian scientists as the religion, but the scientists of Christian thought. And see what they said about this. The ones that founded our understanding of science today. Perhaps the greatest scientist of all time, Newton, viewed his discoveries as showing the creative genius of God's handiwork in nature. Quote, "This most beautiful system of sun, of planets, of comets, could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being." Johann Kepler probably made some of the greatest astronomical discoveries that have ever been made. NASA has a huge page dedicated to Kepler. I printed off part of it here. A list of the firsts from Kepler. First to correctly explain planetary motion. Becoming the founder of celestial mechanics and the first natural laws in the modern sense. Kepler was certain, based upon his deep Christian faith, that God had employed an even more beautiful pattern. That is, from the geocentric model to the heliocentric, the sun. And not only that, but instead of there being perfectly circular motions of the planets, that they were elliptical, and they had another kind of beauty built into them. And he labored hard to decipher it. And when he discovered what it was, his three laws of planetary motion, he experienced something of a spiritual epiphany. Kepler announced that his laws showed that God had used a far simpler and more elegant scheme than the one previously delineated in the Ptolemaic system of cycles and epicycles. In a prayer concluding the harmony of the world, Kepler, the author, Kepler prayed this, that God graciously implored God graciously to cause that these demonstrations may lead to thy glory and the salvation of souls. Ah, how the scientific community has fallen. What we do for the glory of God and for the salvation of souls. It's a powerful influence. We all have it together. We each have it individually. And in some respects, only we have it. It's been assigned to us, the bearers of the name of Christ, to do just that. And whatever it is that we do, discovering the great astronomical principles that guide our world, or taking a cold cup of water to our neighbor, that we manifest the glory of God to the salvation of souls. Maybe there's someone here today who's not walking in the light of Christ. You are missing it, my friend. You are missing all that there is. Woefully undone outside of Christ. You cannot continue to live that way and be happy. And you certainly do not want to die that way. God did not intend this for you. He desires for you to come to a knowledge of the truth and to be saved, to glorify Him so that you can save others. If you would but confess your faith in Jesus as the Son of God, repent of your sins, put Him on in baptism this very hour for the remission of your sins, what a rejoicing you will have, and we will share with you as you go on your way glorifying Him in the person of Christ. Or maybe you're a child of God and you're not walking as you ought to walk and things aren't as they ought to be. What great news you have. You can come back home. Ask for God's forgiveness. If we can encourage you or help you in any way, we hope that you'll let us know while we stand and sing.
Oh, Master.